23. Skip was a little put out about a Saturday workday. He was tired of cataloging Baton's books, or shoveling and screening dirt and finding nothing, and was looking forward to sleeping late and lounging in the RV. But Nora and the crew had wanted to keep working, as they were close to uncovering what Nora believed would be the terminus of the trench. At 11 o'clock that morning, the group assembled for the pre-lunch meeting around a table set up in a tent shade next to the dig. This meeting, Skip sensed as he looked around the group, was going to be different from the usual. Emilio Vigil took a seat next to Nora, his normally black beard covered with dust. The other postdoc, Scott Rorden, sat on the other side, even more dusty. Gnome had joined them unexpectedly, and so had Greg Banks and the other two engineers. Tappan occupied the far end of the table. It seemed the perfunctory mid-morning meeting had turned into a big deal. Skip took a swig of coffee and waited.
"Well," said Nora, opening the meeting. "Emilio, could you tell everyone about the morning's progress?"
"Sure thing." He looked around. "As you all know, we've been excavating the outline of the groove left by the object in the ground. Dr. Baton spent quite a lot of time taking measurements of the furrow."
Baton had asked multiple times for them to halt work while he got down in their trenches and took precise measurements with a laser theodolite. Skip wasn't sure what he was doing, and Baton had been vague when Nora asked.
"Perhaps Dr. Baton would share with us the scope and purpose of his work?" asked Nora rather crisply.
Skip could tell she was a little irritated, and he was equally sure Gnome had his reasons for not revealing exactly what he was up to.
"Not yet, not yet. Soon. I'm working on a little theory of mine. That's all."
Little theory, Skip thought. He was sure not to make eye contact with the man.
"Very well," said Nora. "Go on, Emilio."
"Thanks. We had a major surprise this morning. We reached the end of the furrow, as far as we can tell, and found nothing. Whatever created that furrow seems to have vanished."
"Vanished?"
Tappan asked, suddenly interested.
"How so?"
"It's a bit mysterious, actually," said Nora. "The object came in at a shallow angle. The trench, of course, was backfilled in 1947, but we could still follow its outline. We expected to find a terminus where the object came to rest. But instead, the trench just seemed to spread out and vanish, leaving nothing behind but a welter of sand and fused glass. Skip has been saving quantities of the glassy sand for further analysis by Dr. Banks." Banks nodded. "Our plan going forward," Nora went on, "is to excavate beyond where the furrow disappears to see what else we might find. We also plan to cut several transverse test trenches to see if the object might have scattered pieces to either side. Any questions or thoughts?"
She fielded a number of questions and a discussion ensued, coming to no conclusions. Tappan wrapped it up by thanking Nora and saying,
"We seem to have a real mystery on our hands."
He tried to sound chipper, but Skip could tell this news was a disappointment to him. As the meeting broke up, Gnome signaled Skip to join him. They walked back to Quonset 2, where Gnome ushered Skip into his office and quietly locked the door behind him.
"Please, take a seat."
Skip sat in the chair opposite the desk, thrilled with a sense of anticipation, sure that the man had more to say to him from their talk the evening before.
"You may have noticed me fussing around in the trenches this morning," said Gnome, his eyes sparkling. "I did. Some idea you were checking out?" "Exactly, and my idea bore fruit. Last night I mentioned there was a reason why I shared my story with you. It's because I need your help." "I'm ready to help in any way," Skip said. "I know that. Your sister and everyone else are puzzled about the shape of the furrow plowed by the object, and the mystery of its vanishing. But it's no mystery to me. After taking careful measurements, I believe I know exactly what happened.
He leaned back in his chair with a smile, tenting his fingers, letting a silence build.
What? Skip finally asked. Let me start by saying, I now know we're digging in the wrong place. But the groove in the sand, the glass, the radar surveys, are you saying nothing happened here? Something did happen. The object struck the ground. But my calculation shows that the object came in at such a low angle, it essentially bounced, like a flat stone skipped on the water, and became airborne again and landed somewhere else.
Skip stared.
Holy shit.
Baton chuckled.
This, of course, explains why the groove just ended in a spray of sand and glass. The object simply rebounded back out and flew farther. And so the real crash site is somewhere else,
Skip said.
Precisely. Somewhere in the direction the trench is pointing, and this is where you come in. You're going to be my confidential searcher. Together, we're going to find where the UAP really came to rest.
He unlocked a drawer and pulled out a large sheet of paper. He slid it onto the desk and turned it around so Skip could look. It was full of penciled mathematical equations, and a crude map was hand-drawn in the middle, decorated with arrows and vectors. At the top was an oval, drawn in heavy red pencil.
Our camp is here.
Baton tapped the paper.
And here's the furrow, pointing northwest at a heading of 321 degrees. If you follow that direction, it goes across the dry lake bed and into these hills and buttes. I drew this oval where my preliminary calculations show the object probably came back down to Earth. Of course, a lot depends on its velocity and mass, plus its shape and the amount of drag it produced. And when it hits the ground again, it might have rolled or bounced. We don't know. Yet.
Skip stared at the map.
That oval covers how much area? About 1,000 acres. That's a lot. I know. Tomorrow is Sunday, our day off. I imagine some people are going to go into town, do some shopping or whatever. You and I are going to pack a picnic lunch and tell everyone we're heading off to find the old Spanish watchtower.
Skip hesitated. This was not directly relevant to Baton's abduction story.
Is there a reason why you don't want to share this with everyone? Yes. I need to be the one to discover it. This is my destiny. This is what I was chosen to do by the revelation on Mount Hermon. And when I do find it, naturally, I'll share that discovery with the team. But not until then. Are you with me? Yes, said Skip. I absolutely am. Good. We'll meet here tomorrow morning early at 5:30. Bring your day pack, water, and lunch. You bet.
In his excitement, Skip forgot to be taken aback by the ungodly hour. Baton leaned forward.
Here's the thing. If it did come down somewhere else, it's just possible the government never found it. Which means it's still there.
24. Corey entered the lobby of the Albuquerque field office at 10 minutes to noon on Saturday. She passed through the security barrier, went to the elevator bank, and made her way up to the third floor, going through the motions without much conscious thought, like a zombie. She hadn't slept in the 9 hours since the initial call, but it was shock more than weariness that made everything seem unreal. After hanging up with Garcia, she'd spent a few minutes silently weeping. Then she just lay on her bed, staring at the ceiling, trying to convince herself that none of this was actually happening. It couldn't be. She'd go into work and see Morwood at his desk, looking out through the glass at her,
One skeptical eyebrow arched. But, of course, it wasn't like that, and one way or another, she had to pull herself together. She'd never spent much time on the top floor of the FBI building on weekends, but she sensed an odd, church-like atmosphere the moment she stepped out of the elevator. As she walked through the cube farm, then along the row of offices set against the far wall, this stillness only added to her feeling of unreality. In the distance, barely audible, she could hear a woman sobbing. Funny how she forgot that Morwood had ghosted other agents besides herself. As she approached the corner office, she began to see more people. The death of an FBI agent, even accidental, was not only a tragedy, but a big deal that needed to be investigated. That it happened on the premises made it doubly serious. No doubt that was why Garcia had called her in today. Corey had no illusions she'd been brought in for a grief therapy session. There was no administrative assistant outside Garcia's office, and Corey was still a few minutes early. So she sat down in one of the chairs outside the SAC's door. She closed her eyes and took slow, deep breaths. The sense of disbelief was, in a way, a protective carapace. If she could get through this meeting with that shell intact, maybe it could last the rest of the weekend. The door opened and three or four senior agents in suits filed out. None of them looked at her. Silence for a moment, then she heard, "Swanson, come in, please." Corey stood up and walked into the office. She'd been here only a couple of times, but it had always looked the same. American flag in one corner, FBI flag in another, framed photo of the president between them. Two windows on adjacent walls offering views of the freeway. Neat files on the desk beside a few family pictures. Conference table, chairs, desert landscapes on the walls. She recalled that Morwood had brought her up for an initial meeting after, in his words, deciding she stood a fair chance of sticking around.
"Good morning," Garcia said in his soft voice. "Close the door and take a seat, please."
Garcia's alert brown eyes took her in quickly. He rose to shake her hand as she chose a chair, then sat down again and placed his beefy arms on the desk, hands clasped and fingers interlaced. His mouth was a straight line, neither smiling nor frowning. But then, she'd never seen Garcia either laugh or shout in anger.
"Thank you for coming in, Agent Swanson."
"Yes, sir,"
Corey replied.
"Hail, Agent Morwood, was well-liked here. He was a dedicated agent, respected for his loyalty to the Bureau. This is a tragedy for the entire office, Swanson. We share a common loss. I'm sorry if I seemed short with you on the phone last night."
"Not to worry, sir."
Now Garcia hesitated uncharacteristically. Through her haze of shock and sorrow, Corey had noted there was no folder open in front of the SAC, no recording device visible. This, too, seemed unusual for what she expected to be a debrief. Garcia took a deep breath.
"I think it best to mention something up front, Agent Swanson, so that there's complete transparency, and so you'll better understand my line of questioning."
"Very well, sir," Corey said.
"Transparency about what?"
"As part of the preliminary investigation into the fire, I met with Dr. Lathrop earlier this morning. It is his, recollection that..."
Another hesitation, this one briefer.
"When you and he were together in the forensics lab yesterday, you did not observe proper safety protocols."
Corey was still concentrating on keeping the protective shell in place, and it took a moment for these words to sink in.
"Excuse me, I did what?"
"As part of your work yesterday, you were warming plasticine, correct?"
Corey nodded. Now at last the folder came out. Garcia opened it, glanced over a page or two.
"Dr. Lathrop has stated, for the record, that you were not following guidelines for use of a Bunsen burner.
another glance at the page.
He said there was combustible material in the vicinity of the flame. He also stated that you had not inspected the hose for defects, such as pinch points. Finally, he said this was a behavior he'd seen in you before, leaving a burner unattended, leaving the primary gas valve on after you were done, and the like.
As Garcia spoke, Corey felt the protective bubble melt away and a combination of disbelief, hurt, and anger take its place.
Sir, are you saying Lathrop is accusing me of leaving a burner on and being responsible for that fire? The fire that killed my boss?
Garcia put his hands up in a calming gesture. Unconsciously, Corey had begun to rise out of her chair.
Agent Swanson, please, I'm telling you all this now, at the start, as a courtesy, so you'll have the full picture. Lathrop made no specific accusations. You are not suspected of anything. You know better than anyone, we have teams of professionals who are expert in reconstructing events precisely like this one. They've already sealed off the lab and begun work. It's their findings on the source of the fire that will determine what happened. Not a lone accusation. The recollections of Lathrop or other eyewitnesses, including yourself, are also important, but supplementary.
The SAC let a silence fall. Once again, his bright eyes looked intently at Corey. She had sunk back into her chair, once again in shock. But now of an entirely different kind. Garcia cleared his throat, and when he spoke again, it was in a quieter, almost confidential tone.
What I just told you was by the book. Off the book. I'm truly sorry this has happened. In a fairer world, you'd be given time to mourn, rather than feel a need to defend yourself. Dr. Lathrop is... well... I think you'd agree. He has a certain reputation. But the fact remains, he's been here many years, and it's our job to investigate his claims. I hope you'll understand the necessity to ask you a few questions. Believe me, it's much better this way.
Yes, sir.
Corey drew in a shuddering breath.
Thank you, sir.
Another clearing of the throat, and Garcia was once more his formal, commanding self.
This shouldn't take long.
He plucked a pen from his pocket.
You told me last night that Morwood came by the forensics lab late in the afternoon. At that time, you and Lathrop were working?
I was working. Lathrop was watching.
She'd be goddamned if she ever gave that son of a bitch another break. Garcia made a notation.
What were you engaged in at the time?
I was warming plasticine in a container of water over a burner. For the facial reconstruction, it was necessary in order to apply musculature to the cast of the skull.
What did the three of you talk about?
Mostly about the chance of obtaining a usable ID from the reconstruction. Lathrop thought it likely. I thought it unlikely.
And what did Morwood think?
He seemed pleased with my progress. He specifically asked me to make the presentation at next Tuesday's meeting.
And then Agent Morwood left.
Corey nodded.
What happened next?
We had an argument. Lathrop and I.
About what?
Corey sighed.
Sir, he has a habit of belittling me, making snide, sexist, demeaning comments that, when I point them out, he passes off as jokes. He's been doing it as long as I've been here. He referred to me as a Cassandra in front of Morwood, which I felt was disrespectful. I said if he made another comment along those lines, I'd report him.
Understood.
Garcia was writing again.
The fact is,
I have a degree in forensic anthropology from John Jay, but he acts like...
Understood, Agent Swanson, Garcia said, with a little more iron in his voice. Corey went silent as he continued to make notes. Finally, he looked up again.
You understand, I must ask this next set of questions.
Dr. Lathrop left the lab before you did?
Yes, it's what ended our argument.
And you continued working?
Corey nodded.
How much longer?
Another hour. Perhaps an hour and a quarter.
So what time was it when you left?
Close to 6:30.
And Dr. Lathrop did not return during that period?
No, sir.
Was the Bunsen burner on when he left?
Yes.
How much longer did you make use of it?
Maybe 15 minutes. When the plasticine was soft enough for use, I took it out and turned off the burner, as well as the gas at the main. At no time was gas or flame near any combustible materials.
And can you go over with me, briefly, the steps you took to secure the lab?
When I'd made all the progress I could with the reconstruction, I put the model in a cabinet for safekeeping. I put away my tools, took off my gloves, cleared the work area. I'd already set the Bunsen's collar into the closed position and turned off the gas valve at the work table. And by that time, the burner was cool. I put it away with the other equipment, checked that the main valve was off, made a final survey of the area, then shut off the lights and waited for the security pad to turn green before leaving. As Corey spoke, she expected Garcia to take more notes or record what she said. But instead, he just listened, stroking his beard and watching her. Then he asked a final question.
And you think the reason Morwood went back to the lab that night was to return the object to the evidence locker in the lab, correct?
Corey hesitated. At midnight? I'm not sure.
Do you know any other reason related to what Agent Morwood was working on, or what he was thinking, that might have taken him to the lab that late at night?
No, sir. He sometimes worked late into the evening. Perhaps he wanted to check on the progress of my reconstruction. Garcia took this in with no change of expression. Then, at last, he put the pen back in his pocket and closed the folder.
Thank you, Corey.
Corey felt as disoriented as a pinball on its table. Sir, I want to help.
I know you do, but we have to let the investigation take its course. Since this allegation has been made, you can't be directly involved. You understand?
And my investigation into the identity of the two bodies?
They were badly damaged in the fire. I'm afraid any more work on that will have to wait until the fire investigation is complete.
This sounded dismissive, and Garcia grimaced slightly as he became aware of it.
Don't worry about Lathrop, okay? The best thing you can do is let yourself grieve. Get some distance from all this. In fact, I recommend you take next week off.
But sir,
Agent Swanson, please, a week off. All right?
Yes, sir.
Here's my direct number. In case you need to talk or anything else occurs to you about why Morwood went into the lab late at night.
He reached into a jacket pocket, pulled out a card, and handed it to her.
Now go home, Swanson. And thank you.
Corey began to speak again, only to realize there was nothing more to say. She stood up, mumbled her thanks in return, and then exited the office, feeling even more numb than she had on her way in. 25. Carrying her laptop and feeling oddly nervous, Nora knocked on the door of Tappan's giant RV. A moment later, he flung it open.
Right on time. Come in.
She stepped into the elegant interior while he shut the door behind her.
The table in the middle of the room was covered with various excavation charts and soil profiles.
"Have a seat,"
he said, sweeping aside the charts.
"I asked you here because I'm flummoxed about what was found today. Or, more exactly, not found, and was hoping we could brainstorm a solution. I'm not an archaeologist, so you'll have to be patient."
He punctuated this with a dimpled smile and slipped into a seat on the opposite side.
"Of course. I do have some thoughts about it."
"So, explain to me, archaeologically, just what it means that this furrow, or groove, seems to have just faded into nothingness."
Nora opened her laptop.
"It's easier to show you a three-dimensional reconstruction of the site."
She tapped away, and the overall 3D image came up.
"You'll have to come around to see it."
Tappan sat on the couch next to her.
"This," she said, "is a 3D rendering of the excavation so far. All we've really found of large-scale significance is the groove. You can see that here."
She rotated the image with the press of a button.
"Understood.
It shows that a fairly small object, less than 10 feet in diameter, hit the ground at an angle of about 20 degrees from the horizontal."
10 feet in size? Really?
That's the width of the trench at its narrowest point. If it was round, it was 10 feet in diameter. Of course, it might have been longer, say, cigar or rocket-shaped, and struck point first.
Okay.
It made a large, shallow crater where it first struck. Here. The impact sent out a broad spray of sand, which is where a lot of those microtektites Greg found were created. As you know, it must have been moving really fast to do that. The groove gets narrower and deeper as it plowed into the ground, while the angle gets shallower. At a depth of 12 feet, the groove becomes almost horizontal. And then here, it just seems to dissolve into a big mess.
She rotated and magnified the image.
"It's like the UAP just vanished," he said. "Is that possible?"
"Whatever impacted wouldn't just vanish. I think what we're seeing is where the government bulldozers came through and dug around. They obviously removed whatever was there and destroyed the archaeological integrity of the site in doing so. What's left is all confused. No layering, no structure, just churned up sand and dirt."
She paused.
"So it isn't really the mystery it seemed at first. At least, that's one idea. More excavation and test trenches on either side should clarify things."
"I see," said Tappan. "So whatever made the trench is now sitting in one of those sealed hangars in Area 51.
Nora didn't reply. He glanced at his watch and stood up.
"Stay for a drink?"
Nora hesitated. Her immediate instinct was that this might be a bad idea. Yet she had a hard time putting a finger on what made her, a woman in her mid-30s, think so.
"Sure," she said.
"What's your poison?"
"A glass of white wine would be nice."
"Coming up."
He went over to the bar, pulled a bottle out of the fridge, opened it, and poured a glass. He set it down in front of her and quickly shook up a martini for himself, pouring it into a cocktail glass.
"Cheers."
He tapped her glass and smiled. He took a sip and leaned a little toward her.
"I'm wondering if you've gotten to yes yet."
Nora was momentarily confounded by the question until she realized he was referring to their earlier conversation. She sipped her wine, then set down her glass.
"Well, I was awake half the night, thinking about that super-heavy element discovery and the microtektites. I guess you might say I'm still a skeptic."
"Really?"
"Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence."
You don't think this evidence is extraordinary enough?
There still could be a mistake. Something we haven't thought of. The problem is, you're all true believers. You have to admit, that can distort results. He held up his martini.
I salute and respect your skepticism, even if I think it's going a little overboard.
Then he paused.
What is it?
What is what?
That look on your face.
I don't have a look on my face.
Yes, you do.
Nora sighed.
What the hell?
All right. It's about you, actually.
Me?
Tappan reared back in mock surprise. Well, it's just that you seem to shroud yourself in a veil of ignorance. I mean, she added hastily, about technical stuff. You have a grand vision, you've certainly got the passion and the imagination, but when it comes to the details, you let the scientists speak for you.
And rightly so. That's what I'm paying them for.
I know, but when you get excited about something... Nora was already sorry she'd brought it up, but she soldiered on anyway. You forget about that protective shroud. It drops away.
I don't follow, Tappan said.
Like, after you'd spent all that time in Quonset 1 with Greg, you started explaining super-heavy elements and the island of stability with almost as much familiarity as if you were a physicist yourself. She paused. What I mean is, you seem to know a lot more about physics than you let on. Tappan digested this.
I do?
Yes.
Oh.
He took a sip of his martini.
Busted.
Nora waited until, finally, it was Tappan's turn to sigh.
It's true. I'm a physics geek. Astrophysics, actually.
I figured you didn't become a billionaire inventor out of ignorance. But why the act?
It's not an act, Tappan replied quickly.
And for a moment, Nora thought she'd gone too far. But he simply drained his martini and chuckled.
There are two reasons, really. The first is, I've learned from experience to hire the best people. Give them a nudge or reorient them from time to time, but let them do the talking and the heavy thinking. If I strut my own knowledge, it just hinders them, intimidates them.
Nora nodded. This made sense. And the second?
That's more complicated.
Tappan looked at her glass, hesitated, then rose and made himself another martini. One more, she recalled, than he usually allowed himself. When he sat down again, his face had grown introspective.
You know the old story of the poor working-class parent who toils night and day so their kid can become a doctor or a lawyer? But all the kid wants to do is paint or write sonnets.
Of course. Sounds like the life story of most Victorian novelists.
Well, that's my story too. Except in reverse. My father taught English at a community college in South Dakota. He lived and breathed literature and had dreams of being a writer. He'd struggled all his adolescent life to escape the family farm so he could write and teach. His leaving the farm enraged his father, but he did it anyway. But here's the tragedy. Writing eluded him.
Tappan paused, expression still introspective.
He always wanted to write that perfect, jewel-like novel, like the fellow in Breakfast at Tiffany's. A book full of sensitive, intensely felt prose. But he just didn't have it in him. So the mantle of famous family novelist fell upon me, his firstborn. The problem was, I was much happier fixing a tractor, or lying in the barnyard at night watching for shooting stars, or learning the constellations, or figuring out how a windmill worked. I had little interest in books.
He chuckled again, but this time rather mirthlessly.
My dad, when he wasn't busy teaching class or tearing up drafts of his novel, did everything he could to make me fall in love with literature. He tossed me books by Robert Louis Stevenson and H.G. Wells, even offered me candy bars to finish them.
He shifted on the couch.
It was around that time my mom left home, moved in with her in-laws on what was left of the farm.
Nora thought it best not to overtly sympathize.
So, did you? Finish the books, I mean. Sure, I read them, but after a while, the page-to-candy-bar ratio began to feel onerous. The irony was that I did like the books. Books with numbers in them, such as my algebra and geometry texts. I liked Jules Verne, too, but only for the science and imagination. I tried building a submarine out of two ancient canoes lashed thwart to thwart. Almost incinerated myself improvising a two-stage rocket. I built a radio dish and tried to pick up radio waves from distant star systems. My dad was aware of the irony, of course. Instead of writing short stories, I was tinkering with mechanical stuff. So he just kept writing and rewriting that novel, and he started drinking while doing it. In time, his own failed dreams became, well, my fault. That's when his frustrations started getting physical.
Jesus, Nora murmured. Tappan shrugged this away.
So I followed my mom back to my grandparents' farm. With me there to help, the farm started to come back. And my juvenile studies went from algebra to electrodynamics and mechanical engineering to radio telescopes, black holes, and cosmology. But I never lost my curiosity about the farm's windmill. Over time, I was able to make it generate more than 5 kilowatts of power. This was in the early 90s, after the government passed the PTC measure.
The what?
A corporate tax credit for renewable electrical sources. It made wind turbines interesting, but they were big and they were loud. All my tinkering with our old windmill, combined with what I'd learned about mechanical engineering, had given me ideas for a new kind of direct-drive generator. It could shrink a gearbox, allow for slower rotational speeds, and make the whole mechanism quieter. It was my grandfather who suggested I apply for a patent.
And he picked up his martini.
And? Nora asked. That little idea was the start of everything. At first, it just provided seed money. Now 60% of the wind turbines out there use my patent. Much improved, of course. And my childhood interest in rockets resulted in building an equally efficient vehicle for satellite launches.
He took a sip.
But deep in my limbic brain, I feel guilty for not being a poet. My dad beat that much into me, at least. So keeping my scientific knowledge to myself became habitual.
What happened to your father? Nora asked.
We never spoke again after I ran off to the farm.
Is he still around?
In South Dakota. Retired. Frail. But still drinking and rewriting.
He put down his glass with a little more force than necessary.
But enough about me. Let's hear your story. I know all the details of your CV, of course. Very impressive. Grew up on a ranch outside of Santa Fe. Worked at the Institute. Then went east. Got a position at the New York Museum of Natural History. Came back to Santa Fe. But, I mean, the Institute's fine and all. But what induced you to leave New York and the museum? Was it...
He fell quiet, leaving the rest of the sentence dangling in midair. Nora was aware, of course, that he knew about her marriage and the death of her husband.
Now it was Nora's turn to finish her glass. I loved the museum, she said, and I loved New York. But to answer your question, when Bill was murdered, well, I just couldn't look at the city the same way anymore. I wanted to be back and be with my brother, on home ground, safer ground. There was a silence. I'm sorry, Tappan said at last. I shouldn't pry into such sensitive topics. She shook her head. No, it's not healthy to shut it all up. It's just, well, it's a part of my past I'm still trying to put to rest. Another silence followed. Anyway, said Nora, before the silence became awkward, when are you going to tell everyone the news about the super heavy element? Not quite yet. Tappan paused. Why? Another hesitation. May I tell you something in total confidence? Of course. I'm concerned we might have a mole on our team. Nora waited for more explanation. It isn't anything definite, he said. It's just that I know there are people embedded in the government who have staked their careers on covering this up. They don't want us here. They are extremely concerned about what we're doing, and early on they tried to stop us. Very quietly. When that proved impossible, they seemed to melt away. But they're still there, and they've got a lot riding on keeping the Roswell truth secret. And now we know. We have proof it was an alien spaceship. And I fear this might trigger some sort of reaction.
But are there any specific reasons to think there's a spy on the team?
It's just a feeling.
He picked up his empty martini glass, twirled it between his fingers, set it down.
I know it sounds a little paranoid, but that's why I asked everyone to keep this discovery under wraps a while longer. Oh, and there's one other thing.
He leaned forward as if to impart a secret, but instead their lips touched, lingering gently. Nora, surprised, drew back.
I'm out of line, he said quickly.
Nora, breathing hard, her heart suddenly pounding, tried to compose herself.
This is a bad idea.
Of course it is, said Tappan, leaning forward again, his breath playing on her face.
At that moment, Nora realized she didn't care whether or not it was right. She couldn't help bringing her lips in to meet his again. He slid his arms around her neck, and they kissed ever more passionately. And then his warm hand slipped under her shirt and up her spine while he eased her down on the plush leather banquette. Nora walked back to her trailer in the dark, still reeling from what had just happened. It was crazy. It was wrong. It was exactly what should not happen on a project like this. And yet she felt a powerful glow, a whole body tingle, that made her reservations seem trivial, if not irrelevant. As she came in the door, a marvelous scent, underlaid by Mitty's welcoming bark, brought her back to the present.
Where have you been? Skip called from the galley. A little longer, and you would have ruined dinner.
He quickly poured her a glass of wine and gestured to the kitchen table, where he'd been making inroads into chips and guac.
Have some while I work this up.
Thanks, she said, slipping into her chair. She was famished. She scooped a massive guacamole onto a chip.
I was getting worried, he said from the galley, because someone said you'd gone into Tappan's RV. You were in there an awfully long time.
His voice trailed off suggestively.
Tappan was just showing me some charts, she said briskly.
She found herself flushing, to her great dismay.
Charts, etchings, of course.
Skip tipped a bit of red wine from his glass into the sauté pan with a great hiss of liquid. He stirred it gently, shook the pan, tasted the contents, and then spooned them onto plates, along with roasted potatoes and baby bok choy.
Sautéed foie gras with red wine, Balsamico and mission fig reduction, he said with feigned nonchalance as he slid the plates onto the table.
Wow, this is amazing, Skip.
Least I could do.
He sat down beside her and poured himself a fresh glass of wine.
You know, it wouldn't be so shabby having a billionaire brother-in-law.
His voice trailed off suggestively. She hit him on the shoulder rather harder than she intended. 26. Bitton arrived kitted out as if on safari, with a day pack, two water bottles strapped to his belt, a gigantic straw sun hat, sunglasses, and his nose coated with sunscreen. He carried an elaborate GPS unit. Mitty spied him approaching in the dark and gave a bark, then rushed forward for a greeting. Bitton took a moment to rub his ears, murmuring affectionate words in Hebrew.
We're going to walk in the direction the trench points us in, he said, immediately setting off,
striding so fast Skip struggled to keep up. Mitty bounding ahead eagerly.
The oval I described is about 5 miles away in the Atalaya Plains, and it extends 2 miles into the hills.
Right.
I worked out a search pattern last night. I'll Bluetooth it to you. We're going to split up once we reach the valley to cover more ground.
The sun mounted over the horizon into a cloudless sky, casting golden shadows. It was still chilly in the early morning, but Skip knew it was going to warm up quickly. Hopefully it wouldn't get too hot. For a man close to 50, Bitton proved to be full of energy. As they walked, he told tales of growing up in Be'er Sheva in the Negev Desert, which he mentioned was also the ancient biblical town of Be'er Sheba. And he talked about its history, the place where Abraham planted the tamarisk tree and the Lord spoke to Isaac and Jacob, and later where the Battle of Be'er Sheba took place during World War I. He was a fount of knowledge and stories, and Skip hung on every word. After about 2 miles, Skip saw they were coming to the edge of Diablo Mesa, the vast, low formation on which the camp was situated. A cliff abruptly dropped away to a huge, treeless valley with a dry lake bed in the middle. They stood at the edge of the mesa in the morning light while Bitton consulted his GPS. Skip took a moment to give Mitty some water.
According to the map, that valley is called the Plains of Atalaya, Bitton said. The white area is Dead Lake, and those hills on the other side are the Horsehaven Hills. The buttes beyond are Los Gigantes, and the Blue Mountains, Los Fuertes. Picturesque names. It amazes me how much this landscape looks like the Negev. But now, we have to find our way down into the valley.
Skip peered over the edge with a frown. It was only a few hundred feet, but the rim rock was sheer.
From the topo map, said Bitton, examining his GPS, it looks like there might be a way down the cliffs to the left.
They walked along the mesa edge as the sun climbed in the sky. The views were endless. There were no roads, no trails, no signs of human existence. It was a landscape that made Skip feel small, but in a good way, and the possibility of being part of a discovery that would change the world filled him with excitement and wonder. From time to time, Bitton halted and peered ahead with binoculars.
I'll be damned, he said at one of these stops. Take a look.
He handed the binoculars to Skip. In the distance, at the edge of the mesa, he could see a broken tower of stone.
The watchtower, he said. Here we are, only pretending to look for it, and yet we found it. I take it as a sign we'll be lucky in what we are looking for.
He hastened forward, Skip following. The tower was circular, built of rough stone blocks mortared with adobe. Most of it had fallen down the cliffside, while other stones lay strewn about. Inside, there was just enough shade for them to hunker down and have a drink of water. Mitty lapped his share furiously from a collapsible bowl. Skip noticed some green glazed potsherds and picked one up.
What's that?
Skip handed it to Baton.
Spanish pottery, I would think.
Baton turned it over.
Keep it. We'll show it to your sister. Maybe she can identify it.
Skip hunted around and found a few larger pieces, some with yellow designs, and slipped them in his pocket. After a short rest, they walked past the tower and discovered the remains of an ancient trail going down into the valley. As they descended toward the base of the cliffs, the wind started picking up, carrying white dust from the dry lake bed. The temperature gradually rose. Baton finally seemed to run out of conversation. When they had gotten back on course, they set off across the plains of Atalaya toward the distant hills, Baton periodically checking his GPS. After another 2 hours or so, he halted. The hills were much closer now, and Skip could see they were covered with grass and dotted with low, twisted oak trees.
"We've reached the southern edge of the oval," Baton said. "Time to split up and begin searching. We'll meet back here at 5.
5. That would give them 3 hours to get back to camp before nightfall. This was cutting it close, but Skip decided not to mention it. Baton went over the search pattern Skip was to follow, a downloaded Google Earth file that showed his location and suggested path. Even though they were out of cell range, the satellite coverage was good, and the GPS was working well. But as Skip looked ahead at the hot alkali flats where his search was to begin, his heart sank a little. Already they'd hiked quite a distance in the growing heat. But it would get better, he told himself, when he reached those grassy hills. Mitty was still going strong, and Skip was glad to have him along. Baton, obviously in a hurry, went off with only a few more words toward his half of the search pattern. Skip began tracing his own, hiking first one way, then the other. Baton soon dwindled to a black dot on the plains, and then he vanished entirely. After noon, the heat came up, and at length Skip decided to take a rest and eat his lunch. He was starving and wolfed down the duck roulettes and camembert sandwich he had prepared on French bread. Mitty got sardines and olive oil. Even though Skip was in good shape, he was starting to feel the trek in his legs. He continued on, Mitty now following behind, long red tongue dangling. There was nothing to see, no indication of a UFO crash, just a flat white alkali crust that seemed to go on forever. But as he went back and forth, the inviting-looking hills got closer, and finally, around 4 o'clock, he entered them. At the first corkscrew oak, he took another rest in the shade, drinking the now hot water from his canteen and sharing more with Mitty. He was starting to regret bringing the dog. It was so hot. Baton was nowhere to be seen, but Skip wasn't worried. He knew exactly where he himself was, his position indicated by a little blue dot on the Google Earth image. He went on. The hills were magical, covered with deep grasses that swayed and rippled in the wind, filling the air with the scent of verdure, the scattering of oak trees giving the landscape a park-like feel. And it was cooler, thank God. The buttes and mountains beyond formed a dramatic backdrop. He began to encounter faint trails winding this way and that, and quickly realized they were not human, but horse trails. Wild horses. It excited him to think he might glimpse some. Horse Heaven Hills. The place lived up to the name. The only problem was, as he tramped the hills, he could see no sign of an alien crash site. He checked his watch and at 4:30 realized it was time to make a beeline back to their rendezvous point. He dropped a Google Earth pin to note where he was on the search pattern so he could resume later and headed back out of the hills. He arrived at the rendezvous point at 5 sharp. There was no sign of Baton. He checked his phone, but of course there was no cell reception. The sun sank lower in the western sky, and the air cooled, the wind dying away. A pleasant evening commenced, golden light striping the hills and mountains beyond, the air as clear as a spring pool. He waited an hour. Still, no baton. He thought about heading back, but then considered what would happen if he left and Baton showed up to find him gone. The man would be furious and might stop taking him into his confidence. This was an annoying development, but perhaps not unexpected. Baton was enthusiastic and easily carried away. On the flat plain, there was no hill Skip could climb to look for him. He felt a buzz in his phone, glanced down, and noted the battery was down to 20%. He quickly turned off the GPS and closed Google Earth, and for good measure put the phone in airplane mode to conserve its battery. As dusk gathered, he settled in to wait. 27. Corey sat in the one truly comfortable chair in her apartment, a Peter Max-decorated beanbag relic from the previous tenant, trying to read a heavily abused paperback. The Sunday evening light streamed through the windows that looked out onto the Jade Park neighborhood, throwing stripes across the floor that resembled prison bars. At one point, she realized she wasn't actually reading anymore, her eyes merely scanning dumbly the printed words on yellowing paper. She mustered the willpower to try again. Sometimes in the afternoon sky, a white moon would creep up like a little cloud, furtive, similar to an actress who doesn't have to be on stage for a while, and so goes into the audience to watch the rest of the company a moment, keeping in the background so as not to distract. I liked to see her image reproduced in books and paintings, though they were quite different from the ones I enjoy today. "Fuck!" she yelled, flinging the paperback across the room. It hit a small shelf holding a potted teddy bear choya, and the cactus, shelf, and book all crashed to the floor, scattering dirt and potsherds across the tiles. In high school, back in Medicine Creek, Kansas, she had been an avid reader. She'd take her gremlin and park under the power lines and read everything she could get her hands on. Trashy science fiction, thrillers, horror novels, even the occasional classic. It was all good, as long as the book took her far away from Medicine Creek, her screeching alcoholic mother, and the bullies and cool kids at school. Out of principle, she hadn't paid much attention to her teachers, but one writer her English teacher had mentioned had stayed with her, Marcel Proust, a French author who, the teacher said, wrote books that rambled on endlessly about his experiences growing up. Somehow, that odd idea of a man who spent his entire life reliving his childhood stuck with her. The sheer self-absorption of writing a million-word monologue about oneself. And so, one day, she picked up Remembrance of Things Past and dipped into it. It was tough, tiresome going at times, especially since nothing ever seemed to happen. But slowly the sheer wistful dreaminess of it captivated her and became her go-to escape reading. But not today. Today, nothing helped her escape. Corey knew that spending more time grieving obsessively would be unhealthy. Her mentor's sudden death made her realize just how alone she was, in this new job, in this strange town, in this desert state. She thought of calling her father, or even, strangely enough, Nora Kelly. But neither of them was close enough to the situation to really understand. The only person she wanted to turn to would have been Hale Morwood himself. And of course, he was gone. Only too late, she realized he'd been more than a boss. He'd been a stabilizing influence on her. Not a father figure, but the solid, steadying person she needed at the start of her career. She stared at the mess she'd just created, spread across the tiled floor on the far side of the room. Anger and anxiety began to replace her shock and grief. She could just imagine that pretentious old bastard Lathrop talking shit about her. He'd been against her ever since she arrived, a young woman who was a threat to him and his control of the lab. He blamed her for the fire, and probably thought it would be her word against his. But the fire investigation would surely clear her. At this, she felt a fresh surge of anxiety. The thing was, despite what she'd told Garcia, She couldn't be 100, 1,000% sure she'd shut off the burner and the gas lines. She was pretty confident she had. It was something drilled into her during countless hours spent in the John Jay labs. But who remembered something like that? It was like locking the car door before you walked away. This was bullshit. She'd be exonerated. She knew the fire wasn't her fault. There was no way she was responsible for killing her own mentor. Sitting in her apartment, she felt helpless, unable to do anything. A week off, the time hanging heavy, felt like anything but a period of healing. "Fuck," she said again, but this time quietly, deliberately. She stood, swept up the broken pot and sad little cactus and dumped them into a trash can, and tossed the copy of Proust underhanded onto the beanbag chair. One thing was sure. Wallowing in self-pity was the worst choice she could make. "Here's my private number." She went into the bedroom, pulled Garcia's card from her bag, and, before she could reconsider, dialed his cell number. The phone rang twice.
"Garcia," came the voice.
"Mr. Garcia, sir?" she said. "It's Corinne Swanson."
"Yes."
When he said nothing more, she plunged ahead. "Look, sir, I really appreciate the offer of a week off, but I've given it some thought, and I'd rather be of use, one way or another," she ended lamely. There was a brief pause.
"Are you sure about that, Swanson?"
"Yes, sir, I am. I need to stay busy."
"Very well, then. It might be a good thing after all. As it happens, we may have an interim mentor for you."
Interim? She hadn't known there was such a thing.
"Somebody willing to ghost you on a temporary basis until we can find a permanent replacement. He's been working in the D.C. area for a few years, but has just arrived in Albuquerque to gather evidence on a complicated fraud case. He'll be here for a while, and his background includes a little mentoring work. How about it?"
"Of course. Thank you, sir."
"In that case, I'll reach out and see if he's interested."
And before Corey could thank him again, the line went dead. 28. Skip waited at the rendezvous point, feeling increasingly alarmed. Nome was now more than 2 hours late. The sun was touching the horizon, and Skip could see no sign of him.
"Mitty, where the hell is he?"
Hearing his name, the dog perked up his ears and looked at Skip with searching eyes. Skip scratched him behind the ears, glad for the company. Skip had spent the last hour searching for Baton, following his footprints in the dry lake bed, which was easy enough, but they completely disappeared when Baton had entered the grassy hills. Skip climbed a few hills to get a better view, but could see no trace of him. He finally returned to the rendezvous in a rising panic. A dozen scenarios ran through his mind. That Baton had fallen and hurt himself. That Baton had found the crash site and become so enthralled he'd lost track of the time. That Baton's GPS had run out of juice and he'd gotten lost. That Baton had been bitten by a rattlesnake. He had turned off airplane mode on his phone to send Gnome text messages, but reception was non-existent, even on top of the hills. All it did was run down his battery, which was now at 5%. He'd finally turned off the phone entirely to preserve the last bit. It was at least 6 miles back to the camp, and without his cell phone's GPS, he wasn't sure he could find his way to the cliffs in the dark, where the old trail went up to the mesa top. The sun disappeared below the horizon in a boil of golden light, and twilight fell. Darkness, Skip knew, came quickly in the high desert. And now this had become an emergency. Something had happened to Baton, and Skip needed to get back to camp and get a search launched. But he'd be returning in the dark, on a night with no moon.
He rose and swept his eyes across the dry lake bed one last time. Then he turned and looked back toward the distant rim rock of Diablo Mesa, a black line on the horizon. He couldn't see the watchtower ruins. They were too far away. He needed to figure out which direction to go, and for that, he had to turn on his cell phone. He would get the heading and then turn it back off. With trepidation, he switched it on and waited. The Apple logo appeared, much to his relief. Still, he waited as the phone booted up. The lock screen finally appeared, but the phone chimed and the battery monitor was red. He cursed as he hit the Google Earth app. Now he had to wait for his phone's GPS receiver to acquire satellites and load the app. The GPS in the phone worked even without data reception, of course, and the requisite images had been downloaded, but the program still needed to acquire his position. The GPS receiver used a whole lot of juice, and his battery symbol was just a sliver of red. As if on cue, the screen went black.
"Son of a bitch!" he cried.
His heart began to pound. The sky in the west was deepening to purple. He had been stupid. Very stupid. He should have started back to camp an hour ago. But he'd been too afraid Gnome would return and not find him, and be angry. He squinted back at the distant cliffs of Diablo Mesa. It was already too dark to follow his own faint footsteps. What he would do was walk in the direction they'd come as best he could estimate, and when he hit the cliffs, he'd search for the trail. If he didn't find it in one direction, he'd go try the other. Once atop the mesa, he hoped he'd be able to get a visual bearing on the distant lights of camp.
"Okay, partner," he said to Mitty. "Let's go."
Having a plan reassured him, and he set off at a fast walk toward the distant line of cliffs. The stars began appearing over his head, first the brightest ones along with the planets, and then the vast panoply. The air was cooling nicely, and he still had a little water. He figured it was about 8 o'clock. If all went well, he and Mitty would be back in camp by 10, and then he'd rally the group and return in the vehicles for a proper search. The mesa top could be easily crossed by jeep, and the trail down to the lake bed, next to the tower, was broad enough to be traversable, steep though it was. This would be over soon.
"Keep calm and carry on," he kept murmuring, repeating the phrase that had gotten the British through the Blitz.
He continued toward the dark line of cliffs until night closed in for good. The stars, out here with no light pollution, were amazing, like vast clouds of glowing dust. The moon had not yet risen, and he could no longer see where he was going. The land ahead was just a sea of black. But he scanned the sky and quickly located the North Star, and from that adjusted his route to a southeast heading. If he kept the star at his back, behind his left shoulder, he should be able to maintain a steady course without getting turned around or going in circles. An hour went by, and finally the alkali crust of the lake bed petered away. He felt the ground rising, and in another 10 minutes, he was standing at the foot of the cliffs, a black wall blotting out the night sky. So far, so good. But where was the trail? He took a guess it would be to his left and began hiking along the base of the cliffs in that direction. It was so dark and the cliffs so devoid of form that he found himself having to stop and explore every ridgeline and slope for the trail, none of which panned out, the climb always ending in sheer rock. A half mile brought him at last to a promising ridge. He wished for the 1,000th time that he'd brought a headlamp. But who could have imagined they'd be out after dark? He started up the ridgeline, his heart soaring with hope. It grew steeper, steeper than he remembered, but he kept going. Now it became steeper still. This wasn't the trail, he realized, but it still might be a route to the top. He kept scrambling up, the rock face to the left and right falling away into sheer blackness, using his hands now as well as his feet. Mitty, with 4 legs, was doing better than he was, and he placed a hand on the dog's furry head,
feeling reassured by the touch. The wind picked up and he abruptly felt wobbly, disoriented by vertigo, and quickly sat down to gather his nerves. He turned to look back over the plains of Atalaya and suddenly caught his breath. There were lights. He peered at the tiny points, moving in the ocean of black. They were definitely lights, very distant, hard to resolve. As he stared, he became aware they were moving. One blinked out, then another, then both came back on again. It was impossible to tell exactly where they were in the dark landscape, but it seemed likely they were in the Horse Heaven Hills or possibly beyond. Had Gnome brought a flashlight or headlamp with him? He hadn't mentioned it, and he certainly wouldn't have taken more than one. Skip stared at the lights, growing thirsty as he did so, and took out his water bottle. Damn! He shook it, then took a swig, leaving the last bit. Skip and Nora had grown up on a ranch, and one of the unbreakable rules their father had taught them was never, ever drink the last bit of water in your canteen. Their father had tragically died of thirst in the desert, but when he was found, there was still water in his canteen. After hesitating, he gave the last of the water to Mitty, who lapped it up in seconds. He turned his attention back to the lights. They suggested Bataan might have encountered other people, by accident or design. Were they helping him? Were they just random people? Surely it wasn't a rescue party from camp. Not yet. What the hell were they doing out there, with no roads for miles? The lights seemed to be moving around in strange, almost random patterns. But maybe that was an illusion caused by the blankness of the terrain. It was hard to tell with no fixed landmarks. On top of that, his eyes were dry and irritated from the dust and sun. He tucked the empty water bottle back in his pack and continued up the ridge, which grew ever more terrifying. And then it dead-ended in a wall of rock. Christ Almighty, he would have to make his way back down that slope. Going down was always worse. He turned gingerly, knelt, and began scooting on his butt, little by little. But the slope was extreme, and the ridge all loose gravel and sand, and he suddenly found himself sliding faster and faster. He raked the ground with his hands and dug in his heels, but it did nothing except scratch the hell out of his palms. He cried out, scrabbling desperately, Mitty suddenly barking as he fell faster still, terror gripping his heart.